Nations, I Believe, DGFP, Volume 10, pages 413 to 415. On September 18th, Thompson, in a further report, gave an account of a confidential conversation he said had taken place between Lindbergh and several American general staff officers. Lindbergh gave it as his opinion that England would soon collapse before German air attacks. The general staff officers, however, held that Germany's air strength was not sufficient to force a decision. DGFP, Volume 10, pages 413 to 415. On October 19, 1938, 3 weeks after Munich, Lindbergh had been awarded and had accepted the Service Cross of the German Eagle with Star. This was, I believe, the second highest German decoration, usually conferred on distinguished foreigners who, in the official words of the citations, deserved well of the Reich. Churchill himself, as he related later in his memoirs, was somewhat troubled by the peace feelers emanating through Sweden, the United States, and the Vatican, and, convinced that Hitler was trying to make the most of them, took stern measures to counter them. Informed that the German chargé in Washington, Thompson, had been attempting to talk with the British ambassador there, he cabled that Lord Lothian should be told on no account to make any reply to the German chargé d'affaires' message. To the King of Sweden, who had urged Great Britain to accept a peace settlement, the grim Prime Minister drafted a strong reply. Before any such requests or proposals could even be considered, it would be necessary that effective guarantees by deeds, not words, should be forthcoming from Germany, which would ensure the restoration of the free and independent life of Czechoslovakia, Poland, Norway, Denmark, Holland, Belgium, and above all, France. There are in the DGFP volumes several dispatches to the German Foreign Office about alleged contacts with various British diplomats and personages, sometimes direct, sometimes through neutrals, such as the Franco-Spaniards. Prince Max von Hohenlohe, the Sudeten German Anglophile, reported to Berlin on his conversations with the British minister in Switzerland, Sir David Kelly, and with the Aga Khan. He claimed the latter had asked him to relay the following message to the Führer. The Khedive of Egypt, who is also here, had agreed with him that on the day when the Führer puts up for the night in Windsor, they would drink a bottle of champagne together. If Germany or Italy were thinking of taking over India, he would place himself at our disposal. The struggle against England was not a struggle against the English people, but against the Jews. Churchill had been for years in their pay, and the king was too weak and limited. If he were to go with these ideas to England, Churchill would lock him up. DGFP, Volume 10, pages 294 to 295. It must be kept in mind that these are German reports and may not be true at all, but they are what Hitler had to go on. The Nazi plan to enlist the Duke of Windsor, indeed the plot to kidnap him and then try to use him, as disclosed in the Foreign Office secret papers, is noted later. That was the nub of Churchill's case, and apparently no one in London dreamt of compromising it by concluding a peace that would preserve Britain but permanently enslave the countries Hitler had conquered. But this was not comprehended in Berlin, where, as I recall those summer days, everyone, especially in the Wilhelmstrasse and the Bendlerstrasse, was confident that the war was as good as over. All through the last fortnight of June and the first days of July, Hitler waited for word from London that the British government was ready to throw in the sponge and conclude peace. On July 1st, he told the new Italian ambassador, Dino Alfieri — Attolico had been replaced by Alfieri at the instigation of Ribbentrop in May — that he could not conceive of anyone in England still seriously believing in victory. Nothing had been done in the high command about continuing the war against Britain. But the next day, July 2nd, the first directive on that subject was finally issued by OKW. It was a hesitant order. The Führer and Supreme Commander has decided that a landing in England is possible, providing that air superiority can be attained and certain other necessary conditions fulfilled. The date of commencement is still undecided. All preparations to be begun immediately. Hitler's lukewarm feeling about the operation and his belief that it would not be necessary is reflected in the concluding paragraph of the directive. All preparations must be undertaken on the basis that the invasion is still only a plan and has not yet been decided upon. When Chano saw the Führer in Berlin on July 7th, he got the impression, as he noted in his diary, that the Nazi warlord was having trouble making up his mind. He is rather inclined to continue the struggle and to unleash a storm of wrath and of steel upon the English, but the final decision has not been reached, and it is for this reason that he is delaying his speech, of which, as he himself puts it, he wants to weigh every word. On July 11th, Hitler began assembling his military chiefs on the Obersalzberg to see how they felt about the matter. Admiral Raeder, whose navy would have to ferry an invading army across the Channel, had a long talk with the Führer on that date. Neither of them was eager to come to grips with the problem. In fact, they spent most of their time together discussing the matter of developing the naval bases at Trondheim and Narvik in Norway. The Supreme Commander, judging by Raeder's confidential report of the meeting, was in a subdued mood. He asked the Admiral whether he thought his planned speech to the Reichstag would be effective. Raeder replied that it would be, especially if it were preceded by a concentrated bombing attack on Britain. The Admiral, who reminded his chief that the RAF was carrying out damaging attacks on the principal German naval bases at Wilhelmshaven, Hamburg, and Kiel, thought the Luftwaffe ought to get busy immediately on Britain. But on the question of invasion, the Navy Commander-in-Chief was distinctly cool. He urgently advised that it be attempted only as a last resort to force Britain to sue for peace. He, Raeder, is convinced that Britain can be made to ask for peace simply by cutting off her import trade by means of submarine warfare, air attacks on convoys, and heavy air attacks on her main centers. The CNC Navy, Raeder, cannot for his part therefore advocate an invasion of Britain as he did in the case of Norway. Whereupon the Admiral launched into a long and detailed explanation of all the difficulties involved in such an invasion, which must have been most discouraging to Hitler. Discouraging, but perhaps also convincing. For Raeder reports that the Führer also views invasion as a last resort. 2 days later, on July 13th, the generals arrived at the Berghof above Berchtesgaden to confer with the Supreme Commander. They found him still baffled by the British. The Führer, Halder jotted in his diary that evening, is obsessed with the question why England does not yet want to take the road to peace. But now, for the first time, one of the reasons had begun to dawn on him. Halder noted it. He sees, just as we do, the solution of this question in the fact that England is still setting her hope in Russia. Thus he too expects that England will have to be compelled by force to make peace. He does not like to do such a thing, however. Reasons? If we smash England militarily, the British Empire will disintegrate. Germany, however, would not profit from this. With German blood, we would achieve something from which only Japan, America, and others will derive profit. On the same day, July 13th, Hitler wrote Mussolini, declining with thanks the Duce's offer to furnish Italian troops and aircraft for the invasion of Britain. It is clear from this letter that the Führer was at last beginning to make up his mind. The strange British simply wouldn't listen to reason. I have made to Britain so many offers of agreement, even of cooperation, and have been treated so shabbily, he wrote, that I am now convinced that any new appeal to reason would meet with a similar rejection. For in that country at present it is not reason that rules. 3 days later, on July 16th, the warlord finally reached a decision. He issued Directive No. 16 on the preparation of a landing operation against England. Top Secret. Führer's Headquarters, July 16th, 1940. Since England, despite her militarily hopeless situation, still shows no sign of willingness to come to terms, I have decided to prepare a landing operation against England, and if necessary, to carry it out. The aim of this operation is to eliminate the English homeland as a base for the carrying on of the war against Germany, and if it should become necessary, to occupy it completely. The code name for the assault was to be Sea Lion. Preparations for it were to be completed by mid-August. If necessary, to carry it out. Despite his growing instinct that it would be necessary, he was not quite sure, as the directive shows. The if was still a big one as Adolf Hitler rose in the Reichstag on the evening of July 19th to make his final peace offer to Britain. It was the last of his great Reichstag speeches and the last of so many in this place down the years that this writer would hear. It was also one of his best. I put down my impressions of it that same evening. The Hitler we saw in the Reichstag tonight was the conqueror, and conscious of it, and yet so wonderful an actor, so magnificent a handler of the German mind, that he mixed superbly the full confidence of the conqueror with the humbleness which always goes down so well with the masses when they know a man is on top. His voice was lower tonight. He rarely shouted as he usually does, and he did not once cry out hysterically as I've seen him do so often from this rostrum. To be sure, his long speech was swollen with falsifications of history and liberally sprinkled with personal insults of Churchill, but it was moderate in tone, considering the glittering circumstances, and shrewdly conceived to win the support not only of his own people, but of the neutrals, and to give the masses in England something to think about. "From Britain," he said, "I now hear only a single cry, not of the people, but of the politicians, that the war must go on. I do not know whether these politicians already have a correct idea of what the continuation of this struggle will be like. They do, it is true, declare that they will carry on with the war, and that even if Great Britain should perish, they would carry on from Canada. I can hardly believe that they mean by this that the people of Britain are to go to Canada. Presumably only those gentlemen interested in the continuation of their war will go there. The people, I am afraid, will have to remain in Britain, and will certainly regard the war with other eyes than their so-called leaders in Canada. Believe me, gentlemen, I feel a deep disgust for this type of unscrupulous politician who wrecks whole nations. It almost causes me pain to think that I should have been selected by fate to deal the final blow to the structure which these men have already set tottering. Mr. Churchill, no doubt, will already be in Canada, where the money and children of those principally interested in the war have already been sent. For millions of other people, however, great suffering will begin. Mr. Churchill ought, perhaps, for once to believe me when I prophesy that a great empire will be destroyed, an empire which it was never my intention to destroy or even to harm." Having thus tilted at the dogged Prime Minister and attempted to detach the British people from him, Hitler came to the point of his lengthy speech. "In this hour I feel it to be my duty before my own conscience to appeal once more to reason and common sense in Great Britain as much as elsewhere. I consider myself in a position to make this appeal, since I am not the vanquished begging favors, but the victor speaking in the name of reason. I can see no reason why this war must go on." There was a colorful scene, and one unprecedented in German history, when Hitler suddenly broke off his speech in the middle to award field marshal's batons to 12 generals, and a special king-size one to Göring, who was given the newly created rank of Reich Marshal of the Greater German Reich, which put him above all the others. He was also awarded the Grand Cross of the Iron Cross, the only one given during the entire war. Halder was passed over in this avalanche of field marshal awards, being merely promoted one grade from lieutenant general to general. This promiscuous award of field marshalships, the Kaiser had named only 5 field marshals from the officer corps during all of World War I, and not even Ludendorff had been made one, undoubtedly helped to stifle any latent opposition to Hitler among the generals, such as had threatened to remove him on at least 3 occasions in the past. In achieving this, and in debasing the value of the highest military rank by raising so many to it, Hitler acted shrewdly to tighten his hold over the generals. 9 army generals were promoted to field marshal: Brauchitsch, Keitel, Rundstedt, Bock, Leib, Liszt, Kluge, Witzleben, and Reichenau, and 3 Luftwaffe officers: Milk, Kesselring, and Sperle. He was not more specific than that. He made no concrete suggestions for peace terms, no mention of what was to happen to the 100 million people now under the Nazi yoke in the conquered countries. But there were few, if any, in the Reichstag that evening who believed that it was necessary at this stage to go into the details. I mingled with a good many officials and officers at the close of the session, and not one of them had the slightest doubt, as they said, that the British would accept what they really believed was a very generous and even magnanimous offer from the Führer. They were not for long to be deceived. I drove directly to the Rundfunk to make a broadcast report of the speech to the United States. I had hardly arrived at Broadcasting House when I picked up a BBC broadcast in German from London. It was giving the British answer to Hitler already, within the hour. It was a determined no. Churchill later declared that this immediate and brusque rejection of Hitler's peace offer was made by the BBC without any prompting from His Majesty's government, as soon as Hitler's speech was heard over the radio. Churchill, Their Finest Hour, page 260. Junior officers from the High Command and officials from various ministries were sitting around the room listening with rapt attention. Their faces fell. They could not believe their ears. "Can you make it out?" one of them shouted to me. He seemed dazed. "Can you understand those British fools?" he continued to bellow. "To turn down peace now? They're crazy." The same evening, Chano heard the reaction to the crazy English on a much higher level in Berlin than mine. The Italian foreign minister had behaved like a clown during the Reichstag session, bobbing up and down like a jack-in-the-box to give the fascist salute every time Hitler paused for breath. I also noticed Quisling, a pig-eyed little man, crouching in a corner seat in the first balcony. He had come to Berlin to beg the Führer to reinstate him in power in Oslo. Late in the evening, Chano noted in his diary, when the first cold English reactions to the speech arrive, a sense of ill-concealed disappointment spreads among the Germans. The effect on Mussolini, according to Chano, was just the opposite. He defines it a much too cunning speech. He fears that the English may find in it a pretext to begin negotiations. That would be sad for Mussolini, because now more than ever he wants war. The Duce, as Churchill later remarked, need not have fretted himself. He was not to be denied all the war he wanted. As a maneuver calculated to rally the German people for the fight against Britain, I wrote in my diary that night, Hitler's speech was a masterpiece, for the German people will now say, Hitler offers England peace and no strings attached. He says he sees no reason why this war should go on. If it does, it's England's fault. And was that not the principal reason for giving it 3 days after he had issued Directive No. 16 to prepare the invasion of Britain? He admitted as much, beforehand, to two Italian confidants, Alfieri and Chano. On July 1st, he had told the ambassador, "It was always a good tactic to make the enemy responsible in the eyes of public opinion in Germany and abroad for the future course of events. This strengthened one's own morale and weakened that of the enemy. An operation such as the one Germany was planning would be very bloody. Therefore, one must convince public opinion that everything had first been done to avoid this horror." In his speech of October 6th, when he had offered peace to the West at the conclusion of the Polish campaign, he had likewise been guided by the thought of making the opposing side responsible for all subsequent developments. He had thereby won the war, as it were, before it had really started. Now again he intended, for psychological reasons, to buttress morale, so to speak, for the action about to be taken. A week later, on July 8th, Hitler confided to Chano that he would stage another demonstration so that in case the war should continue, which he thought was the only real possibility that came into question, he might achieve a psychological effect among the English people. Perhaps it would be possible by a skillful appeal to the English people to isolate the English government still further in England. It did not prove possible. The speech of July 19th worked with the German people, but not with the British. On July 22nd, Lord Halifax, in a broadcast, made the rejection of Hitler's peace offer official. Though it had been expected, it somehow jolted the Wilhelmstrasse, where I found many angry faces that afternoon. "Lord Halifax," the official government spokesman told us, "has refused to accept the peace offer of the Führer. Gentlemen, there will be war." It was easier said than done. In truth, neither Hitler, the High Command, nor the general staffs of the Army, Navy, and Air Force had ever seriously considered how a war with Great Britain could be fought and won. Now, in the midsummer of 1940, they did not know what to do with their glittering success. They had no plans and scarcely any will for exploiting the greatest military victories in the history of their soldiering nation. This is one of the great paradoxes of the Third Reich. At the very moment when Hitler stood at the zenith of his military power, with most of the European continent at his feet, his victorious armies stretched from the Pyrenees to the Arctic Circle, from the Atlantic to beyond the Vistula, rested now and ready for further action, he had no idea how to go on and bring the war to a victorious conclusion. Nor had his generals, 12 of whom now bandied field marshals' batons. There is, of course, a reason for this, although it was not clear to us at the time. The Germans, despite their vaunted military talents, lacked any grand strategic concept. Their horizons were limited. they had always been limited, to land warfare against the neighboring nations on the European continent. Hitler himself had a horror of the sea. "On land I am a hero, but on water I am a coward," he told Rundstedt once. Schulman, Defeat in the West, page 50. And his great captains almost a total ignorance of it. They were land-minded, not sea-minded, and though their armies could have crushed in a week the feeble land forces of Britain if they had only been able to come to grips with them, even the narrow waters of the Dover Straits which separated the two, so narrow that you can see across to the opposite shore, loomed in their minds, as the splendid summer began to wane, as an obstacle they knew not how to overcome. There was, of course, another alternative open to the Germans. They might bring Britain down by striking across the Mediterranean with their Italian ally, taking Gibraltar at its western opening, and in the east, driving on from Italy's bases in North Africa, through Egypt, and over the canal to Iran, severing one of the empire's main lifelines. But this necessitated vast operations overseas at distances far from home bases, and in 1940 it seemed beyond the scope of the German imagination. Thus, at the height of dizzy success, Hitler and his captains hesitated. They had not thought out the next step and how it was to be carried through. This fateful neglect would prove to be one of the great turning points of the war, and indeed of the short life of the Third Reich and of the meteoric career of Adolf Hitler. Failure, after so many stupendous victories, was now to set in. But this, to be sure, could not be foreseen as beleaguered Britain, now holding out alone, girded herself with what small means she had for the German onslaught at the summer's end. Chapter 22. Operation Sea Lion. The Thwarted Invasion of Britain. The final German victory over England is now only a question of time, General Jodl, Chief of Operations at OKW, wrote on June 30, 1940. Enemy offensive operations on a large scale are no longer possible. Hitler's favorite strategist was in a confident and complacent mood. France had capitulated the week before, leaving Britain alone and apparently helpless. On June 15th, Hitler had informed the generals that he wanted the army partially demobilized, from 160 to 120 divisions. The assumption behind this, Halder noted in his diary that day, is that the task of the army is fulfilled. The Air Force and Navy will be given the mission of carrying on alone the war against England. In truth, the army showed little interest in it, nor was the Führer himself much concerned. On June 17th, Colonel Walter Varlamont, Jodl's deputy, informed the Navy that, "With regard to the landing in Britain, the Führer has not up to now expressed such an intention. Therefore, even at this time, no preparatory work of any kind has been carried out in OKW. 4 days later, on June 21st, at the very moment Hitler was entering the armistice car at Compiègne to humble the French, the Navy was informed that "the Army General Staff is not concerning itself with the question of England, considers execution impossible, does not know how operation is to be conducted from southern area. General Staff rejects the operation." None of the gifted planners in any of the three German armed services knew how Britain was to be invaded, though it was the Navy, not unnaturally, which had first given the matter some thought. As far back as November 15, 1939, when Hitler was trying vainly to buck up his generals to launch an attack in the West, Raeder instructed the Naval War Staff to examine the possibility of invading England, a possibility arising if certain conditions are fulfilled by the further course of the war. It was the first time in history that any German military staff had been asked even to consider such an action. It seems likely that Raeder took this step largely because he wanted to anticipate any sudden aberration of his unpredictable leader. There is no record that Hitler was consulted or knew anything about it. The furthest his thoughts went at this time was to get airfields and naval bases in Holland, Belgium, and France for the tightening of the blockade against the British Isles. By December 1939, the Army and Luftwaffe high commands were also giving some thought to the problem of invading Britain. Rather nebulous ideas of the three services were exchanged, but they did not get very far. In January 1940, the Navy and Air Force rejected an army plan as unrealistic. To the Navy, it did not take into account British naval power. To the Luftwaffe, it underestimated the RAF. In conclusion, remarked the Luftwaffe General Staff in a communication to OKH, a combined operation with a landing in England as its object must be rejected. Later, as we shall see, Goering and his aides were to take a quite contrary view. The first mention in the German records that Hitler was even facing the possibility of invading Britain was on May 21st, the day after the armored forces drove through to the sea at Abwehr. Raeder discussed in private with the Führer the possibility of a later landing in England. The source of this information is Admiral Raeder, whose navy was not sharing in the glory of the astounding victories of the Army and Air Force in the West, and who, understandably, was seeking means of bringing his service back into the picture. But Hitler's thoughts were on the Battle of Encirclement to the north and on the Somme front then forming to the south. He did not trouble his generals with matters beyond these two immediate tasks. The naval officers, however, with little else to do, continued to study the problem of invasion. And by May 27th, Rear Admiral Kurt Fricke, chief of the Naval War Staff Operations Division, came up with a fresh plan entitled Studi England. Preliminary work was also begun on rounding up shipping and developing landing craft, the latter of which the German Navy was entirely bereft. In this connection, Dr. Gottfried Feder, the economic crank who had helped Hitler draft the party program in the early Munich days and who was now a state secretary in the Ministry of Economics, where his crackpot ideas were given short shrift, produced plans for what he called a war crocodile. This was a sort of self-propelled barge made of concrete, which could carry a company of 200 men with full equipment, or several tanks or pieces of artillery, roll up on any beach and provide cover for the disembarking troops and vehicles. It was taken quite seriously by the naval command and even by Halder, who mentioned it in his diary and was discussed at length by Hitler and Raeder on June 20th, but nothing came of it in the end. To the admirals, nothing seemed to be coming of an invasion of the British Isles as June approached its end. Following his appearance at Compiègne on June 21st, Hitler went off with some old cronies to do the sights of Paris briefly, and to gaze down at the tomb of Napoleon at the Invalides. That, he told his faithful photographer, Heinrich Hoffmann, was the greatest and finest moment of my life. And then to visit the battlefields, not of this war, but of the First War, where he had served as a dispatch runner. With him was his tough top sergeant of those days, Max Amann, now a millionaire Nazi publisher. The future course of the war, specifically how to continue the fight against Britain, seemed the least of his concerns, or perhaps it was merely that he believed that this little matter was already settled, since the British would now come to reason and make peace. Hitler did not return to his new headquarters, Tannenberg, west of Freudenstadt, in the Black Forest, until the 29th of June. The next day, coming down to earth, he mulled over Jodl's paper on what to do next. It was entitled The Continuation of the War Against England. Though Jodl was second only to Keitel at OKW in his fanatical belief in the Führer's genius, he was, when left alone, usually a prudent strategist. But now he shared the general view at Supreme Headquarters that the war was won and almost over. If Britain didn't realize it, a little more force would have to be supplied to remind her. For the siege of England, his memorandum proposed three steps: intensification of the German air and sea war against British shipping, storage depots, factories, and the RAF, terror attacks against the centers of population, a landing of troops with the objective of occupying England. Jodl recognized that the fight against the British Air Force must have top priority, but on the whole he thought this as well as other aspects of the assault could be carried out with little trouble. Together with propaganda and periodic terror attacks, announced as reprisals, this increasing weakening of the basis of food supply will paralyze and finally break the will of the people to resist, and thereby force its government to capitulate. As for a landing, it could only be contemplated after Germany has gained control of the air. A landing, therefore, should not have as its objective the military conquest of England, a task that could be left to the Air Force and Navy. Its aim should rather be to administer the death blow, Todesstoß, to an England already economically paralyzed and no longer capable of fighting in the air, if this is still necessary. Jodl also suggested the possibility of extending the war to the periphery, that is, attacking the British Empire with the help not only of Italy but of Japan, Spain, and Russia. However, thought Jodl, all this might not be necessary. Since England can no longer fight for victory but only for the preservation of its possessions and its world prestige, she should, according to all predictions, be inclined to make peace when she learns that she can still get it now at relatively little cost. This was what Hitler thought, too, and he immediately set to work on his peace speech for the Reichstag. In the meantime, as we have seen, he ordered, July 2nd, some preliminary planning for a landing, and on July 16th, when no word of reason had come from London, issued Directive No. 16 for Sea Lion. At last, after more than 6 weeks of hesitation, it was decided to invade Britain, if necessary. This, as Hitler and his generals belatedly began to realize, would have to be a major military operation, not without its risks, and depending for success on whether the Luftwaffe and the Navy could prepare the way for the troops against a far superior British Navy and a by no means negligible enemy air force. Was Sea Lion a serious plan? And was it seriously intended that it should be carried out? To this day, many have doubted it, and they have been reinforced in their opinions by the chorus from the German generals after the war. Rundstedt, who was in command of the invasion, told Allied investigators in 1945, "The proposed invasion of England was nonsense, because adequate ships were not available. We looked upon the whole thing as a sort of game, because it was obvious that no invasion was possible when our navy was not in a position to cover a crossing of the Channel or carry reinforcements. Nor was the German Air Force capable of taking on these functions if the navy failed. I was always very skeptical about the whole affair. I have a feeling that the Führer never really wanted to invade England. He never had sufficient courage. He definitely hoped that the English would make peace." Blumentritt, Rundstedt's chief of operations, expressed similar views to Little Hart after the war, claiming that, "among ourselves, we talked of it, Sea Lion, as a bluff." I myself spent a few days at the middle of August on the Channel, snooping about from Antwerp to Bologna in search of the invasion army. On August 15th at Calais and at Cap Grinet, we saw swarms of German bombers and fighters heading over the Channel toward England on what turned out to be the first massive air assault. And while it was evident that the Luftwaffe was going all out, the lack of shipping, and especially of invasion barges in the ports and in the canals and rivers behind them, left me with the impression that the Germans were bluffing. They simply did not have the means, so far as I could see, of getting their troops across the Channel. But one reporter can see very little of a war, and we know now that the Germans did not begin to assemble the invasion fleet until September 1st. As for the generals, anyone who read their interrogations or listened to them on cross-examination at the Nuremberg trials learned to take their post-war testimony with more than a grain of salt. Even so astute a military critic as Little Hart neglected always to do so, and this neglect mars his book, The German Generals Talk. Talk they did, but not always with very good memories or even very truthfully. The trickiness of man's memory is always considerable, and the German generals were no exception to this rule. Also, they had many axes to grind, one of the foremost being to discredit Hitler's military leadership. Indeed, their principal theme, expounded at dreary length in their memoirs and in their interrogations and trial testimony, was that if they had been left to make the decisions, Hitler never would have led the Third Reich to defeat. Unfortunately for them, but fortunately for posterity and the truth, the mountainous secret German military files leave no doubt that Hitler's plan to invade Britain in the early fall of 1940 was deadly serious, and that, though given to many hesitations, the Nazi dictator seriously intended to carry it out if there were any reasonable chance of success. Its ultimate fate was settled not by any lack of determination or effort, but by the fortunes of war, which now, for the first time, began to turn against him. On July 17th, the day after Directive No. 16 was issued to prepare the invasion, and 2 days before the Führer's peace speech in the Reichstag, the Army High Command, OKH, allocated the forces for Sea Lion and ordered 13 picked divisions to the jumping-off places on the Channel coast for the first wave of the invasion. On the same day, the Army Command completed its detailed plan for a landing on a broad front on the south coast of England. The main thrust here, as in the Battle of France, would be carried out by Field Marshal von Rundstedt, as he would be titled on July 19th, as commander of Army Group A. Six infantry divisions of General Ernst Busch's 16th Army were to embark from the Pas-de-Calais and hit the beaches between Ramsgate and Bexhill. Four divisions of General Adolf Strauss's 9th Army would cross the channel from the area of Le Havre and land between Brighton and the Isle of Wight. Farther to the west, three divisions of Field Marshal von Reichenau's 6th Army, from Field Marshal von Bock's Army Group B, taking off from the Cherbourg Peninsula, would be put ashore in Lyme Bay between Weymouth and Lyme Regis. Altogether, 90,000 men would form the first wave. By the third day, the High Command planned on putting ashore a total of 260,000 men. Airborne forces would help out after being dropped at Lyme Bay and other areas. An armored force of no less than 6 panzer divisions, reinforced by 3 motorized divisions, would follow in the second wave, and in a few days it was planned to have ashore a total of 39 divisions plus 2 airborne divisions. Their task was as follows. After the bridgeheads had been secured, the divisions of Army Group A in the southeast would push forward to the first objective, a line running between Gravesend and Southampton. Reichenau's 6th Army would advance north to Bristol, cutting off Devon and Cornwall. The second objective would be a line between Maldon on the east coast north of the Thames estuary to the Severn River, blocking off Wales. Heavy battles with strong British forces were expected to develop at about the time the Germans reached their first objective. But they would be quickly won, London surrounded, and the drive northward resumed. Raukisch told Raeder on July 17th, that the whole operation would be finished in a month and would be relatively easy. German intelligence overestimated British strength on the ground throughout July, August, and September by about 8 divisions. Early in July, the German general staff estimated British strength at from 15 to 20 divisions of fighting value. Actually, there were 29 divisions in England at this time, but not more than half a dozen of much fighting value, as they had practically no armor or artillery. But contrary to widespread belief at the time, which has lingered to this day, the British Army by the middle of September would have been a match for the German divisions then allocated for the first wave of invasion. By that time, it had ready to meet an attack on the south coast a force of 16 well-trained divisions, of which 3 were armored, with 4 divisions plus an armored brigade covering the east coast from the Thames to the Wash. This represented a remarkable recovery after the debacle at Dunkirk, which had left Britain virtually defenseless on land in June. British intelligence of the German plans was extremely faulty, and for the first 3 months of the invasion threat, almost completely wrong. Throughout the summer, Churchill and his military advisers remained convinced that the Germans would make their main landing attempt on the east coast, and it was here that the bulk of the British land forces were concentrated until September. But Raeder and the Naval High Command were skeptical. An operation of such size on such a broad front, it stretched over 200 miles from Ramsgate to Lyme Bay, was simply beyond the means of the German Navy to convoy and protect. Raeder so informed OKW 2 days later and brought it up again on July 21st, when Hitler summoned him, Braukitsch, and General Hans Jeschenek, chief of the Luftwaffe General Staff, to a meeting in Berlin. The Führer was still confused about what is going on in England. He appreciated the Navy's difficulties, but stressed the importance of ending the war as soon as possible. For the invasion, 40 divisions would be necessary, he said, and the main operation would have to be completed by September 15th. On the whole, the warlord was in an optimistic mood, despite Churchill's refusal at that very moment to heed his peace appeal. "England's situation is hopeless," Halder noted Hitler as saying. "The war has been won by us. A reversal of the prospects of success is impossible." But the Navy, faced with the appalling task of transporting a large army across the choppy channel in the face of a vastly stronger British Navy and of an enemy air force that seemed still rather active, was not so sure. On July 29th, the Naval War Staff drew up a memorandum advising against undertaking the operation this year and proposing that it be considered in May 1941 or thereafter. Hitler, however, insisted on considering it on July 31, 1940, when he again summoned his military chiefs, this time to his villa on the Obersalzberg. Besides Raeder, Keitel and Jodl were there from OKW and Brauchitsch and Halder from the Army High Command. The Grand Admiral, as he now was, did most of the talking. He was not in a very hopeful mood. September 15th, he said, would be the earliest date for Sea Lion to begin, and then only if there were no unforeseen circumstances due to the weather or the enemy. When Hitler inquired about the weather problem, Raeder responded with a lecture on the subject that grew quite eloquent and certainly forbidding. Except for the first fortnight in October, the weather, he explained, was generally bad in the Channel and the North Sea. Light fog came in the middle of that month and heavy fog at the end. But that was only part of the weather problem. The operation, he declared, can be carried out only if the sea is calm. If the water were rough, the barges would sink and even the big ships would be helpless, since they could not unload supplies. The admiral grew gloomier with every minute that he contemplated what lay ahead. "Even if the first wave crosses successfully," he went on, "under favorable weather conditions, there is no guarantee that the same favorable weather will carry through the second and third waves. As a matter of fact, we must realize that no traffic worth mentioning will be able to cross for several days until certain harbors can be utilized." That would leave the army in a fine pickle, stranded on the beaches without supplies and reinforcements. Raeder now came to the main point of the differences between the army and the navy. The army wanted a broad front from the Straits of Dover to Lyme Bay, but the navy simply couldn't provide the ships necessary for such an operation against the expected strong reaction of the British Navy and Air Force. Raeder therefore argued strongly that the front be shortened, to run only from the Dover Straits to Eastbourne. The admiral saved his clincher for the end. "All things considered," he said, "the best time for the operation would be May 1941. But Hitler did not want to wait that long. He conceded that, naturally, there was nothing they could do about the weather, but they had to consider the consequences of losing time. The German navy would not be any stronger vis-à-vis the British navy by spring. The British army at the moment was in poor shape. But give it another 8 to 10 months, and it would have from 30 to 35 divisions, which was a considerable force in the restricted area of the proposed invasion. Therefore, his decision, according to the confidential notes made by both Raeder and Halder, was as follows. Diversions in Africa should be studied, but the decisive result can be achieved only by an attack on England. An attempt must therefore be made to prepare the operation for September 15, 1940. The decision as to whether the operation is to take place in September or is to be delayed until May 1941 will be made after the Air Force has made concentrated attacks on southern England for 1 week. If the effect of the air attacks is such that the enemy air force, harbors, and naval forces, etc., are heavily damaged, Operation Sea Lion will be carried out in 1940. Otherwise, it is to be postponed until May 1941. All now depended on the Luftwaffe. The next day, August 1st, Hitler issued as a consequence 2 directives from OKW, one signed by himself, the other by Keitel. Führer's Headquarters, August 1st, 1940. Top Secret. Directive number 17 for the conduct of air and naval warfare against England. In order to establish the conditions necessary for the final conquest of England, I intend to continue the air and naval war against the English homeland more intensively than heretofore. To this end, I issue the following orders. 1. The German Air Force is to overcome the British Air Force with all means at its disposal and as soon as possible. 2. After gaining temporary or local air superiority, the air war is to be carried out against harbors, especially against establishments connected with food supply. Attacks on the harbors of the South Coast are to be undertaken on the smallest scale possible in view of our intended operations. 4. The Luftwaffe is to stand by in force for Operation Sea Lion. 5. I reserve for myself the decision on terror attacks as a means of reprisal. 6. The intensified air war may commence on or after August 6th. The Navy is authorized to begin the projected intensified naval warfare at the same time. Adolf Hitler. The directive signed by Keitel on behalf of Hitler the same day read in part, Top Secret. Operation Sea Lion. The CNC Navy, having reported on July 31st that the necessary preparations for Sea Lion could not be completed before September 15th, the Führer has ordered, "Preparations for Sea Lion are to be continued and completed by the Army and Air Force by September 15th. 8 to 14 days after the launching of the air offensive against Britain, scheduled to begin about August 5th, the Führer will decide whether the invasion will take place this year or not. His decision will depend largely on the outcome of the air offensive." In spite of the Navy's warning that it can guarantee only the defense of a narrow strip of coast, as far west as Eastbourne, preparations are to be continued for the attack on a broad basis, as originally planned. The last paragraph only served to inflame the feud between the Army and Navy over the question of a long or a short invasion front. A fortnight before, the Naval War Staff had estimated that to fulfill the demands of the Army for landing 100,000 men with equipment and supplies in the first wave, along a 200-mile front from Ramsgate to Lyme Bay, would necessitate rounding up 1,722 barges, 1,161 motorboats, 471 tugs, and 155 transports. Even if it were possible to assemble such a vast amount of shipping, Raeder told Hitler on July 25th, it would wreck the German economy, since taking away so many barges and tugs would destroy the whole inland waterway transportation system, on which the economic life of the country largely depended. At any rate, Raeder made it clear, the protection of such an armada, trying to supply such a broad front against the certain attacks of the British Navy and Air Force, was beyond the powers of the German naval forces. At one point, the Naval War Staff warned the Army that if it insisted on the broad front, the Navy might lose all of its ships. But the Army persisted. Overestimating British strength as it did, it argued that to land on a narrow front would confront the attackers with a superior British land force. On August 7th, there was a showdown between the two services when Halder met his opposite number in the Navy, Admiral Schnevent, the chief of the Naval War Staff. There was a sharp and dramatic clash. "I utterly reject the Navy's proposal," the Army General Staff Chief, usually a very calm man, fumed. "From the point of view of the Army, I regard it as complete suicide. I might just as well put the troops that have landed straight through a sausage machine." According to the Naval War Staff's record of the meeting, Schnevent replied that it would be equally suicidal to attempt to transport the troops for such a broad front as the Army desired, in view of British naval supremacy. In his diary entry that evening, Halder did not quote himself as above. He declared, however, that the talk led only to the confirmation of an unbridgeable gap. The Navy, he said, was afraid of the British High Seas Fleet and maintained that a defense against this danger by the Luftwaffe was impossible. Obviously, by this time, the German Navy, if not the Army, had few illusions about the striking power of Goering's Air Force. It was a cruel dilemma. If a broad front with the large number of troops to man it was attempted, the whole German expedition might be sunk at sea by the British Navy. If a short front, with correspondingly fewer troops, was adopted, the invaders might be hurled back into the sea by the British Army. On August 10th, Brauchitsch, the commander-in-chief of the Army, informed OKW that he could not accept a landing between Folkestone and Eastbourne. However, he was willing, albeit very reluctantly, to abandon the landing at Lyme Bay in order to shorten the front and meet the Navy halfway. This was not enough for the hard-headed admirals, and their caution and stubbornness were beginning to have an effect at OKW. On August 13th, Jodl drafted an appreciation of the situation, laying down five conditions for the success of Sea Lion that seemingly would have struck the generals and admirals as almost ludicrous had their dilemma not been so serious. First, he said, the British Navy would have to be eliminated from the south coast, and second, the RAF would have to be eliminated from the British skies. The other conditions concerned the landing of troops in a strength and with a rapidity that were obviously far beyond the Navy's powers. If these conditions were not fulfilled, he considered the landing an act of desperation, which would have to be carried out in a desperate situation, but which we have no cause to carry out now. If the Navy's fears were spreading to Jodl, the OKW operations chief's hesitations were having their effect on Hitler. All through the war, the Führer leaned much more heavily on Jodl than on the chief of OKW, the spineless, dull-minded Keitel. It is not surprising, then, that on August 13th, when Raeder saw the Supreme Commander in Berlin and requested a decision on the broad versus the narrow front, Hitler was inclined to agree with the Navy on the smaller operation. He promised to make a definite ruling the next day after he had seen the Commander-in-Chief of the Army. After hearing Brauchitsch's views on the 14th, Hitler finally made up his mind, and on the 16th an OKW directive signed by Keitel declared that the Führer had decided to abandon the landing in Lime Bay, which Reichenau's 6th Army was to have made. Preparations for landings on the narrower front on September 15th were to be continued, but now, for the first time, the Führer's own doubts crept into a secret directive. Final orders, it added, will not be given until the situation is clear. The new order, however, was somewhat of a compromise, for a further directive that day enlarged the narrower front. Main crossing to be on narrow front, simultaneous landing of 4,000 to 5,000 troops at Brighton by motorboats, and the same number of airborne troops at Deal Ramsgate. In addition, on D-1 day, the Luftwaffe is to make a strong attack on London, which would cause the population to flee from the city and block the roads. Although Halder, on August 23rd, was scribbling a shorthand note in his diary that, on this basis, an attack has no chance of success this year, a directive on August 27th over Keitel's signature laid down final plans for landings in four main areas on the south coast between Folkestone and Selsey Bill, just east of Portsmouth, with the first objective, as before, a line running between Portsmouth and the Thames, east of London at Gravesend, to be reached as soon as the beachheads had been connected and organized and the troops could strike north. At the same time, orders were given to get ready to carry out certain deception maneuvers, of which the principal one was Autumn Journey, Erbstreise. This called for a large-scale feint against Britain's east coast, where, as has been noted, Churchill and his military advisers were still expecting the main invasion blow to fall. For this purpose, four large liners, including Germany's largest, Europa and Bremen, and 10 additional transports, escorted by four cruisers, were to put out from the southern Norwegian ports and the Heligoland Bight on D-2 day and head for the English coast between Aberdeen and Newcastle. The transports would be empty and the whole expedition would turn back as darkness fell, repeating the maneuver the next day. On August 30th, Brauchitsch gave out a lengthy order of instructions for the landings, but the generals who received it must have wondered how much heart their army chief now had in the undertaking. He entitled it Instruction for the Preparation of Operation Sea Lion, rather late in the game to be ordering preparations for an operation that he commanded must be carried out from September 15th. The order for execution, he added, depends on the political situation, a condition that must have puzzled the unpolitical generals. On September 1st, the movement of shipping from Germany's North Sea ports toward the embarkation harbors on the Channel began, and 2 days later, on September 3rd, came a further directive from OKW. The earliest day for the sailing of the invasion fleet has been fixed as September 20th, and that of the landing for September 21st. Orders for the launching of the attack will be given D-10 day, presumably therefore on September 11th. Final commands will be given at the latest on D-3 day, at midday. All preparations must remain liable to cancellation 24 hours before 0 hour. Keitel. This sounded like business, but the sound was deceptive. On September 6th, Raeder had another long session with Hitler. The Führer's decision to land in England, the Admiral recorded in the Naval Staff War Diary that night, is still by no means settled, as he is firmly convinced that Britain's defeat will be achieved even without the landing. Actually, as Raeder's long recording of the talk shows, the Führer discoursed at length about almost everything except Sea Lion, about Norway, Gibraltar, Suez, the problem of the USA, the treatment of the French colonies, and his fantastic views about the establishment of a North Germanic Union. If Churchill and his military chiefs had only got wind of this remarkable conference, the code word Cromwell might not have been sent out in England on the evening of the next day, September 7th, signifying invasion imminent and causing no end of confusion, the endless ringing of church bells by the Home Guard, the blowing of several bridges by Royal Engineers, and the needless casualties suffered by those stumbling over hastily laid mines. Churchill says that neither he nor the chiefs of staff were aware that the decisive code word Cromwell had been given. It was sent out by headquarters of the Home Forces, their finest hour, page 312. But 4 days later, on September 11th, the Prime Minister did broadcast a warning that if the invasion were going to take place, it could not be long delayed. Therefore, he said, we must regard the next week or so as a very important period in our history. It ranks with the days when the Spanish Armada was approaching the Channel, and Drake was finishing his game of bowls, or when Nelson stood between us and Napoleon's Grand Army at Boulogne. But on the late afternoon of Saturday, September 7th, the Germans had begun their first massive bombing of London, carried out by 625 bombers, protected by 648 fighters. It was the most devastating attack from the air ever delivered up to that day on a city. The bombings of Warsaw and Rotterdam were pinpricks beside it, and by early evening the whole dockside area of the great city was a mass of flames, and every railway line to the south, so vital to the defense against invasion, was blocked. In the circumstances, many in London believed that this murderous bombing was the prelude to immediate German landings, and it was because of this more than anything else that the alert, "Invasion imminent," was sent out. As will shortly be seen, this savage bombing of London on September 7th, though setting off a premature warning and causing much damage, marked a decisive turning point in the Battle of Britain, the first great decisive struggle in the air the earth had ever experienced, which was now rapidly approaching its climax. The time for Hitler to make his fatal decision to launch the invasion or not to launch it was also drawing near. It was to be made, as the September 3rd directive stipulated, on September 11th, giving the armed services 10 days to carry out the preliminaries. But on the 10th, Hitler decided to postpone his decision until the 14th. There seemed to have been at least two reasons for the delay. One was the belief at OKW that the bombing of London was causing so much destruction, both to property and to British morale, that an invasion might not be necessary. The Germans were greatly impressed by reports from the embassy in Washington, which relayed information received there from London and embroidered on it. The American General Staff was said to believe that Britain couldn't hold out much longer. According to Lieutenant Colonel von Losberg, Im Wehrmachtführungsstab, page 91, Hitler seriously expected a revolution to break out in Britain. Losberg was an army representative on OKW. The other reason arose from the difficulties the German Navy was beginning to experience in assembling its shipping. Besides the weather, which the naval authorities reported on September 10th as being completely abnormal and unstable, the RAF, which Goering had promised to destroy, and the British Navy were increasingly interfering with the concentration of the invasion fleet. That same day, the Naval War Staff warned of the danger of British air and naval attacks on German transport movements, which it said had undoubtedly been successful. 2 days later, on September 12th, HQ of Naval Group West sent an ominous message to Berlin. Interruptions caused by the enemy's air forces, long-range artillery, and light naval forces have, for the first time, assumed major significance. The harbors at Ostend, Dunkirk, Calais, and Boulogne cannot be used as night anchorages for shipping because of the danger of English bombings and shelling. Units of the British fleet are now able to operate almost unmolested in the Channel. Owing to these difficulties, further delays are expected in the assembly of the invasion fleet. The next day, matters grew worse. British light naval forces bombarded the chief Channel invasion ports, Ostend, Calais, Boulogne, and Cherbourg, while the RAF sank 80 barges in Ostend Harbor. In Berlin that day, Hitler conferred with his service chiefs at lunch. He thought the air war was going very well and declared that he had no intention of running the risk of invasion. In fact, Jodl got the impression from the Führer's remarks that he had apparently decided to abandon Sea Lion completely, an impression which was accurate for that day, as Hitler confirmed the following day, when, however, he again changed his mind. Both Raeder and Halder have left confidential notes of the meeting of the Führer with his commanders-in-chief in Berlin on September 14th. The Admiral managed to slip Hitler a memorandum before the session opened, setting forth the Navy's opinion that the present air situation does not provide conditions for carrying out the operation, Sea Lion, as the risk is still too great. At the beginning of the conference, the Nazi warlord displayed a somewhat negative mood, and his thoughts were marred by contradictions. He would not give the order to launch the invasion, but neither would he call it off, as, Rader noted in the Naval War Diary, he apparently had planned to do on September 13th. What were the reasons for his latest change of mind? Halder recalled.